Well, good evening and welcome to the sixth presentation in this, our 11th series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue back there, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster, Hai Wan Mon, back here taking pictures, and our instruction coordinator, Brian Carson. Brian Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Shannon Miller. Our speaker tonight is a native of Detroit, where she was born in the pre-feminist 40s, she says, and grew up in the 50s and 60s in a blue-collar family headed by a dominant European father. Growing up, she recalls making frequent visits to Detroit's sister city of Windsor, Ontario, Canada, and during one of those trips, she strolled into a tiny bookstore called South Shore Books and discovered collections of poetry by Canadian women, which became one of her lifelong research interests. After an MA in communications from Wayne State University in Detroit, she continued her studies at Michigan State University, where she received her PhD in English, writing a dissertation entitled A Place of Rupture, The Life and Poetry of Bronwyn Wallace, one of those poems she had read as a child sitting on the floor in that bookstore. She's been a Reader's Red Cedar Writing Project teacher consultant. She's worked with Inside Out, a literary arts project in Detroit, has served the Theodore Rothke House as a grant writer and oral historian, and has worked as an oral historian for the Marshall Frederick Sculpture Museum in Saginaw, Michigan. She's published essays, poems, and short fiction, and chapters in Writers in the Classroom and the Women of Country Music. Her most recent book, The Killing Jar, is based on a true story of the life of one of the youngest Americans to be charged with a capital crime and sentenced to death. It was published in 2012 by Neverland Publishing of Miami. When not teaching or writing, she enjoys spending time with her family, time in her garden, and time with her horses, dogs, and cats. Please give a warm welcome to Gloria Nixon-John. Gloria.
That introduction made me feel like I was at my own wake. It was so wonderful. I want to thank Peggy and Brian and everyone who's been carting me around for a couple of days. I feel like I should have had my first life in this community with the people here. I feel like I should have lived here. And I haven't had that feeling in many places that I travel to talk about this book. The idea for this book came to me when the psychologist who handled the case of Todd Ice, the 15-year-old who went into the trailer of his neighbor and killed his 7-year-old neighbor and nearly killed her mother. The psychologist contacted me. He saw my writing somewhere, I'm not sure where, and he said, he knew I wrote poetry and academic work as well. He said, I think you have the combination to do what I can't do. He said, this case has been haunting me, and I can't write. Can you help me out? And so I went into this area that I never dreamed I would research. I spent 7 years researching, interviewing, doing qualitative research, looking at files and diaries, police records, records for the Department of Social Services, and talking to people all over your state and in other states as well, who either had a hand in what went on during this trial, who had a part in the life of the perpetrator of the crime. And so I became so intimately involved with it, it then led me to become active working with some of the prisoners who have become friends of mine. Yes, I have friends in those low places in the penitentiary, and there's some of the, you won't believe me now, but you need to find out, some of the finest people that I know. And I'm sure you'll have questions, so I'm not going to talk for the whole time. I will do a reading as well. I like to start by saying that I know this is a dark story, because after I did the research and when I started doing the writing, there were days when I crawled into bed and put the covers up over my head, because everything seemed to be closing in on me. It made me very sad and depressed. And I think a lot of people would turn away from this story because the child was the victim of the crime. I think I had to write it because I think two children were victims of this crime. Of course, the young child that was brutally murdered, and I don't excuse the crime, but I also don't excuse the community that time after time had the opportunity to intervene and help the perpetrator, chose to ignore it, make fun of him, close their eyes to it, and not step in. Whenever I hear about a shooting somewhere or a violent crime that's committed by a young man, and I hear the news focus on one little area, they blame it on this or they blame it on that, I now get very upset. Before I leave today, I'm going to show you kind of an outline of what I found in my research. There are actually 7 or 8 factors that you can watch for if you think someone is moving toward violent behavior that will give you an opportunity to intervene. I'm going to start with a reading at the very beginning of the book, and my publisher was very wise because the editor said she wanted me to start here. This isn't where I originally started. And when I read, when I showed this portion to the psychologist who was handling the case, he said to me, "Gloria, it almost scares me that you were able to get into the delusions of the young man that you're writing about." I call him Ted in the book, but everyone knows at this point in time that this is the story of Todd Ice in Powell County. And I have a handout that has a little explanation of the real case. But Todd had delusions of a bearded man everywhere he went. He saw him everywhere and felt threatened by him. And this kind of is the beginning of that delusion that is woven throughout the book. Even in the dark, he knew the land, praised the gullies and rocky plateaus, the modest footpaths for their solitude. He knew the craggy jutting of the hills, the stoic black locusts pointing upward toward a place of promise, away from the misery in the hollows below. He was so attuned to this land that his footfalls became a rhythm to which the other creatures sang along in clicks and caws. He knew the names of all things up on the mountain, knew the birds by their calls, and the trees by silhouette, no matter the season. Sometimes he walked as a scientist, cataloging what he found, what he saw. Sometimes he was a pilgrim, foraging along an otherwise untrodden path. This was his peaceful place, the only place he could be alone, the only place far enough away from his mother. But in the past few days, Ted had been watched, no denying that. He had been watched by a bearded man, lurking behind trees and rocks. But since the man never came forward, never approached him, he had convinced himself that the sighting was a mirage, a trick of shadow and light, a cluster of shape-shifting clouds. He comforted himself with the notion of illusion. Then suddenly, the Bigfoot of a man is on him, pinning him to the ground and wielding a knife. As they tumble together on the damp ground, it becomes difficult for Todd to see where his own arms end and the muscled arms of the massive man began. The blade on the bearded man's hunting knife is thin like the blade on his own knife, but Ted knows that thin doesn't count for much. His father had taught him that. It is contour that makes a knife dangerous. He knows that the curved point can easily slice through skin, penetrate past flesh and muscle into the deep beet-red organs. He imagined his own entrails hanging like a string of sausage in the bearded man's smoking shed. He considered screaming for help, but that would be futile. He has come to this place to be alone, and now he is alone with the bearded man. Small and thin for 15, Ted is surprisingly strong from years of hauling water, years of using the pitchfork and shovel to clean stalls, from wielding a pickaxe to remove rocks for spring planting. He knows his strength, knows to push harder and harder still, but the man just grunts against his efforts, pushes back with an even more savage determination. The heavy hopelessness that Ted carries around with him down in the hollows makes him consider giving up. He could die at the hands of Brute here in the only beautiful place he knows. Instead, he allows the gears of his fear and rage to ratchet up toward a place of deeper resolve, the place where instinct takes over, instinct that comes from eons of land and sea creatures who, when facing a larger captor, used agility and raw will to break free, to crawl under rock, skitter off into a hole, spitting into the man's glowing eyes, wriggling frenetically as if possessed by demons himself. Ted breaks free, rolls over a sharp ledge of rock, then down a muddy slope. He gets to his feet and runs and runs. One of the things that you'll find out when you read the book is that Ted's mother was emotionally abusive, sometimes physically abusive, but the worst thing she did was starve her children. And while she was starving her children, a regular day was two pieces of bread with peanut butter. And while she was starving her children, the state of Kentucky allowed this woman to foster and adopt other children. At one point in time, she had eight people in her trailer and wasn't feeding them. The last child she took in was a young Korean boy. And the reason I remember that so vividly was reading the social services report that the interview that they did, and I interviewed this woman as well, but the interview they did of a waitress who saw Ted's mother come into the restaurant with her new foster child, sit down, order a hamburger, french fries, and a Coke, eat in front of the child and give him the crust on the bun. That's what we're dealing with. So sometimes it isn't just physical abuse. There are other forms of abuse, and sometimes they're not as obvious because there aren't bruises that are visible. I tell you that because you're all going to become people I send out into the world to look for some signs when I'm done here today. To give you an idea, and remember, I took some liberties, but this is about 95% accurate. The liberties I took with this text was to color the pictures, to paint for you what I learned from reading the documents. So it's heavily documented. This next passage, Ted was a bug collector and won state awards for his collection. He was a straight-A student and had IQ higher than mine. Was diagnosed eventually as paranoid schizophrenic with delusions. But this is him in his bedroom. He shared that room with several other children most of the time, but he had a little area off to the side where he worked on his bug collection. He's an easy fit on the small chair, and it bothers him that his body does not seem to be growing as fast as the bodies of the other boys in school. His face doesn't show any signs of impending manhood, not even peach fuzz, just an occasional blemish on an otherwise creamy, girlish complexion. He adjusts the bug to the requisite 10 millimeters from the top of the pin before placing it on a triangle of styrofoam that he will use to frame the specimen on the mounting board. The acrid fumes makes him reel with lightheadedness. He closes his eyes and floats into the buzz, doesn't notice that his mother has entered the bedroom until she is standing over him, blocking the light from the dingy overhead bulb. She's wearing a worn navy shirtwaist dress, the only article of clothing he has ever seen her iron. Still, no matter how perfectly ironed the dress is, her large body resembles a pile of lumpy sofa cushions. It strikes him that she is the opposite of the slight, delicate beauties on the mounting board. He knows, however, that his mother's strike is filled with more venom than all of the specimens combined. "Baby boy," she coos, "did you forget about church night? It's Wednesday night, Bible study and potluck." She doesn't wait for an answer. "You know I love you like you love those ugly, squiggly things, don't you? You know I'm proud of you. You're my smart boy." Ted sits still, silent, fearing what follows her compliments, what always follows her compliments. A speck of pink lipstick, the color of Pepto-Bismol, is smudged on her front tooth as she smiles down at him. The hair just above her ears beginning to turn gray, wiry, and sharp. Her smile seems genuine. "No, don't trust her," he thinks. "Not now. Not ever." the mantra spins in his head, while just like Quicksilver, she changes, begins to inhale deeply, tiny red continents of anger forming on her forehead and cheeks. Soon she will turn on him, strife and sting. And so, perched on the small wooden chair, he freezes, his knobby knees up grasshopper style. He can only look down, notices that his fingernails are bitten to the quick. He braces for the blow. She lets out an exasperated sigh, then spews, let me see what you have there, bug boy, her voice moving down into her throat, coming from behind a gullet of fat. A wheel bug? What do you want with a common old wheel bug? It's not a wheel bug. The reply is thoughtless, dangerous, but still he can't help but correct her. He knows bugs. He repeats, not a wheel bug, not really. This here is an ambush. A little different. But before he's finished, she's lifting him up by the back of his flannel shirt. It's church night, you heathen heretic. Put those dirty things away and wash up for supper. Kind of see where... you're going to see later that this is kind of a pattern that sometimes in the home where religion is used as a tool, it's used as a tool to make people conform to maybe even a moral standard that isn't right, but it's used as a threat, and in this home, that's exactly what's going on. On the one hand, she would one day she would tell him how wonderful he was, and then the next day she was criticizing, obviously, the thing that she complimented the day before. So a child in that situation is constantly ready, but doesn't really know how they're going to have to react in a situation. It's very confusing. Add that to the fact that he was really diagnosed as schizophrenic, and that the signs of that started to show up when he was about 14. Angers me that the teachers who have documented that they knew something was going on and very wrong, they too were part of that community that didn't do anything to intervene. Well, what happened was, of course, he was guilty of the crime. Yes, he committed the brutal murder. But the first trial was nothing short of a circus. What happened was, the trial was held in this small community. The judge was related to some of the people involved in the case. If you can believe this, elementary school children brought their classes into the courtroom to watch what was happening and listen to the details of the crime. People were threatened, the defense attorney, the psychologist with whom I worked was shot at, and he had to get out of town quickly. And of course, all of this, the conclusion was an obvious one. And at that time in this country, you could charge a teen with a capital crime and sentence him to death. So off he goes to the state penitentiary. Has anyone ever seen the state penitentiary in Eddyville? I know a couple of you have in the audience. It's such a beautiful setting. The first time I saw it, well, I stayed at a bed and breakfast on the hill above this beautiful antebellum house. And I'm coming down the hill, and there's this massive stone structure built by Italian stonemasons. Looks like a king and a queen should be, until you start noticing the barbed wire fences. And there's a lake. It's right on the lip of the lake. And one particular day, which led me to more research, of course, because by nature I'm a teacher, so what else am I going to do? Coming down the slope, I noticed that it looked to me like there was a city or streets or something on a clear day at the bottom of that water. And I thought, it's happened. I really do have his delusions. I've become the character that I'm writing about. Maybe I should write about someone rich and famous. The logic goes. I found out by doing research that there was, in fact, a town in Eddyville Lake, that the town was flooded over, because it was flooding anyway all the time. So eventually, they came in and removed most of the buildings and flooded that area. And so there is a plat where the streets used to be on a clear day that you can see. So here's what I did with that, because one of the psychologists talked to Ted about it, and also I was privy to have his diaries and letters and his poems. The drive from Fox County to Lakesville is several hours of scenic parkway through natural forest, interrupted here and there with the pocked patches left from surface mining. Once off the parkway and on through Fredonia, clusters of prefab and trailer homes sit just off the road, some rusted over, others neat with whirligig lawn ornaments and handmade Halloween decorations. They pass a small horse farm, then a small square plot or cemetery, so old that the headstones are worn down to thumb-shaped, nameless pillars. Then the land under them rises up to a scenic plateau, curves around and down to a breathtaking view of the massive limestone penitentiary on the lip of the lake. The sheer size of the place, the turreted facade and elongated arch windows, sweeping steps up to its many doors, diminishes surrounding structures, including the whitewashed antebellum mansion on an adjacent hill. To Ted, the place is stunning. It is indeed a castle, a fortress, and perhaps he thinks he will be safe here, finally safe from the bearded man. He turns his attention to the lake, watches as the autumn wind makes the lake into mirror shards. For a moment, he sees clear to the bottom of the lake. Thinks he sees sidewalks and roads, a plat laid out for development, people walking about, unaware that the lake will soon freeze over and become their icy tomb. Sure that what he sees is just a trick, he instinctively tries to raise his hands to his face so that he can rub his eyes, but his hands are shackled to his leather waistband, and they spring back down as if they are being controlled by someone else. Once they are at street level to the castle, Ted looks up at it. The windows are ablaze from the reflected sun. He wants to see inside. On the drive, Sheriff Riley told him that inmates have written home to tell their loved ones about the strength, that even when tornadoes blow through the area, it's only the penitentiary's massive water tower that gives in the wind of it. Ted stumbles in his leg irons as they begin their walk up the three-tiered ceremonial steps that lead to the front door of the penitentiary. Cotton gets a better grip on Ted's left arm, and Riley takes the other. Together, they lift him up onto each step as if Ted isn't there. Riley tells Cotton that the boy's body feels like the sick foal he once found in his shed. While still alive, the foal was all jetted bone and feather light until death and rigor mortis made it heavy as stone. Cotton reaches over with his free hand, moves it up and down the boy's forearm in a soothing gesture. At the very top of the stairs, Riley stops abruptly, forcing all three of them to stumble, nearly topple backwards. Riley points up to the words carved into the stone above the threshold of the massive structure, and he reads, "Abandon all hope, ye that enter here," and adds in a bravado that suggests a sinister triumph, "You got that, boy?" Ted looks Riley in the eyes. "Dante," he says, and again, "Dante." But the sense of the word flies over the heads of the two officers. Higher still, above the turrets, above the smokestacks, the guard tower, up and up to where the rolling clouds mock the intent of barbed-wired assurances. Well, Ted spends a total of 9 years there. The cell is about as far as I am from that archway to the room where the electric chair is kept. In fact, some of the men on the road told me that one night, one afternoon they were out doing something, cleaning or something, and they were able to get into that room themselves. When I had my first tour, they take you, if anyone tours, they'll take you in there to look at the electric chair closely. And my first visit, when I stood there, I could see my own reflection in the glass, and the electric chair here, and here I am. And I came very pale and nearly passed out, and they had to kind of usher me out of the place. And I imagined then, he was 16 by that time, but I imagine a 16-year-old living in a cell, a paranoid schizophrenic, that close to the electric chair. Well, he was in some ways lucky that two famous attorneys in Kentucky took on the case, filed an appeal, won a new trial, and got him off on guilty with manslaughter, but pronounced insane. But guess what the state of Kentucky wanted to do then? With the attorneys and the psychiatrists saying he's dangerous to himself and others, the state wanted to let him walk right out the door. Instead, these two attorneys and the psychiatrist almost had to fight as hard to get him into a mental institution as they had to get him off of death row. He served in the mental institution for a while, another 7 or 8 years, and then was sent to a group home with nobody really watching whether or not he was taking his medicine. He died in 2010, and the doctor that attended him in the hospital said he literally ate himself to death. Remember, he was starved, and he was on a lot of psychotropic drugs when he took them, which make you gain weight anyway, and he ate everything he could get his hands on, and had a massive heart attack at the age of 47 on his birthday. And I'm only going to read one more little passage from my book, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about the results of my research and the warning and what I want to leave you with this evening, and then I'll talk about questions. I didn't want to go into the talk about who's on death row right now and what happens to juveniles in most states in this country. I'd rather focus on what we can do as a community to prevent this from happening to anyone else. But this particular entry really haunts me after going into that penitentiary several times myself. February 5th, 1981, from Ted's diary. Lenny Masterson, death row. He paces and paces. The concrete floor knows his shuffling steps well. He says he does it to keep the blood flowing. He remembers a death row inmate who lost his legs because of lack of exercise back in the 60s. They were not allowed out of their cells in the 60s. Roommate did not walk or pace in the cell. His legs just quit working. He crawled to the cell door to get his food tray, which was shoved under his door. They took him to the hospital, legs amputated, given an overdose of morphine. He died, courtesy of the state penitentiary. I spend my days waiting for the mail and the nights waiting for sleep. February 13, 81. Pounding, clanging, ever pounding. Hammer on anvil, boom. Door of my cage slamming, echo slamming. Total of my existence. I'm going to pause because I'm looking for some water. And also, as many times as I do this, that passage gets me very upset. Okay, so this moved me into all kinds of research, so far out of the fields that I was studying. And there's a lot of research. There's a bibliography up here for you if you care to take one with you of the main sources that I used beyond the qualitative research that I did. And a lot of those resources are from other countries where they decided to study what goes on in the mind of violent children. One of the famous books is called Children Who Kill. And to that next page. And as a result of my research, I put together this list with the help of those sources that I mentioned in my bibliography. Some of the things that we need to look for as a community to try to prevent things like this from happening. We know in his case there was a family history of mental illness. We know of the physical and mental abuse. A lot of people don't think about number three, and I want you to watch for it. Rigid moral expectations, religious fanaticism. when I hear about the cases on the news, I can start, if I research, checking off some of these. His mother used religion. I talked about that before. And number four, confusion over praise and punishment. Public ridicule. Neighbors would not just ridicule his mother in front of him, but would ridicule the ragtag look of these children. Would ridicule when they came to church on Wednesday night potluck and couldn't get enough food in their mouths. So instead of saying, why are these children acting this way? Why are they so hungry? They were made fun of. The only time they had extra food, by the way, was when grandma was alive and staying with them, because one of the neighbors used to bring over jars of gravy and biscuits to treat grandma, and then the children in the house got to eat the biscuits and gravy too. Well, when grandma died, grandma was the only loving support for those children. And when she died, not only was her love taken away, but the biscuits and gravy went with her. Alcohol and drug abuse. You know, I've had people, I get all kinds of email, a lot of it nasty just because I'm talking about this case. And I have classmates who are now, you know, in their late 40s, who write to me and say things like, what are you talking about? He wasn't abusing alcohol or drugs. Well, he was. It made me think of a student I used to have, a ninth grade student, who would come to school every morning smelling of onions. And I'd tell the social worker, something's going on. And I was one of those teachers that I was at the social worker's office all the time. Something's going on. You better see what's going on. The social worker would come back to me and say, what are you talking about? After lunch, he was fine. Well, my student was eating an onion in the morning to cover up the smell of the alcohol. And I realized later that that's a trick. It's something that'll leave that smell. But there's documentation. Of course, they did blood work when they took him in. And he was drinking more than he was smoking, but he was also smoking pot. And the teachers were aware of it. Access to guns and other weapons. I know that goes without saying that a lot of kids in certain parts of the country use that excuse that they're using it for hunting. Warrior types. I have a neighbor like that in my country home. She said to me one day, well, if a foreign militia comes walking down the road in Oxford, Michigan, my sons will be able to protect you. I said, what about the drones? Who's going to protect me from the drones? So, and he, you know, guns and once they realized how sick he was, they were able to find animals and skins and things. He was killing a lot of smaller animals, not for food, but just to kill them, to get rid of some of that anger. I know from our research also that sometimes children who kill really want to kill mom or dad or grandpa, but they can't kill an abusive person that they're related to. So eventually that anger spills over and they kill someone else. Or they kill a parent and then commit suicide. They don't usually kill the parent and live. They usually kill themselves as well. Number eight is big. Because sometimes you could have all these other things going on, but if you don't have eight, you're pretty okay. And that's the triggering event. And the triggering event can be a combination of things or one of these two. Loss of a loved one. And sometimes it's the loved one, the only loved one you have in your life. The other one is the feeling of being trapped. Ted was going into his neighbor's trailer, foraging for food, and he had been doing it for a long time, and they knew it. On the day he committed this horrible crime, mom and the child doubled back to get something they had forgotten, and he was in the kitchen, in the corner of the kitchen, foraging for food. And he was trapped, and he used his hunting knife. And he would have used a gun if he could have found the bullets, but he couldn't. He was trying to find the bullets of the gun that was in that house, sitting there waiting for them. Children who commit violent crimes have invariably been victimized by violent adults. A recent study of 200 serious juvenile offenders found that over 90% of them had suffered childhood trauma. 74% of the total sample had been physically, sexually, and/or emotionally abused, and over 30% had lost a significant person in their life to whom they were emotionally attached. So you can have someone with all this going on, and then father leaves the home. And that could be part of the triggering of that. And then on the bottom of the sheet, if you want to just scroll down so I can hear me. Because I'm a grandmother and this stuff scares me sometimes. I added these questions for discussion because I work with a lot of teachers and they like to, I have a lot of psychology, sociology, criminal justice students in my audiences when I go to university, and I like to leave these questions for people to look at and think about. I've become a meddlesome type person. I mean, if I see someone in a grocery store with a baby in the cart, a young toddler, and I see that child being slapped around, I follow the person out to the parking lot to get the license plate number and report it, and I follow up. I ask them to call me. And if the police won't do anything, I'll call social services. If social services won't do anything, I'll call the police so they both have a record. And then I start asking around in the community. And I find sometimes that, oh yeah, I know that family. You know, those kids are running all over the place and mom works all day and no one's home. So you have to be kind of nosy like I am and get involved. I'm watching my time, so I'm thinking, and by the way, I have handouts of all of this for you so that you don't have to write it down, you can take it with you. But I do want to ask you for questions, and nothing's off limits here. So if you have questions for me, I'd be glad to listen. Yes? Yes? Thank you for that question, because I kind of skipped over talking about that. No, she never was evaluated. There's other people, her siblings and other people in her family were diagnosed. One young girl that she did bring into her home as a foster child was too strong-willed to put up with it, was intact emotionally, and convinced social services to let her leave that house. She was a 15-year-old girl, and the mother really had a lot of trouble with her. The mother constantly complained about, you know, she'll never listen to anything I do. And this girl had made friends and was, you know, found a way to survive that the young man I wrote about couldn't, didn't have the wherewithal to do that. Yes? Well, what I do is I find a secondary place where those, maybe I shouldn't be giving my secrets away, a secondary source who also has that information. For example, legal files, which are usually available for the public. Police files are available. So there's a way around it. The hardest part for me, however, was convincing people to let me interview. And I had a course at the university in qualitative research design, which really saved me because there are techniques you can use to try to get people to meet with you and to open up. Focus on the person you're interviewing first before you ask them about the information. So a lot of it was public record by the time I worked on it because it's so old. And attorneys were very helpful, and the police were not hesitant at all. Libraries had some of it. Newspaper articles all over the place were very helpful. And then I did talk to some journalists who had a lot of notes, wrote an article, but in their other notes that they didn't use for the article, they still had those notes available. So I had that as well. But it was not easy. I was in Kentucky a lot.
Yes.
I haven't read the book yet, but I was wondering if you could address this situation with all the issues about prisons and prison issues.
Yes, I'm familiar with that. You did? Oh, I need to talk to you. I know he has legal issues of his own. And they were listed, they were, the question she asked was I familiar with or did I know anything about the trouble that the psychologist got into, the legal trouble he had of his own. And that's an interesting story because you know his own father was in jail. Did you know that? Yeah. His own father was in jail for embezzlement. And I have a feeling that that's one of the reasons he ended up in his field, concerned about people who were incarcerated. Yep, and he had a political scandal. He never went to jail for it, but it almost ruined him financially. But still, he was going to pay me a lot of money to be a ghostwriter. But I was saying at dinner tonight, my ego's too big to be a ghostwriter. No matter how much money you give me, I can't go there. Yes.
Now, what was the role of the father? Talk about that mother.
That's really important. I'm glad you asked because usually there's one parent that's absent, and the father lived there. And one of the scenes, the scene I read where he's in his bedroom, and the mother's berating him, I skipped over some things there because I don't like to hear my own voice all that much. But the father used to know what was going on. He'd come in, he'd stand in the doorway, watch all this abuse, and then walk away. He wouldn't get involved. And there's one passage where, I don't know if I earmarked it, but there's one section where Ted finally, at the very end, he says, here it is. He says, now I look back through my various writings and notice that on December 22nd of 88, whatever this means, the hero got his head chopped off, the hero died, and the mom was a bitch, and dad was a woof woof. I also didn't used to be able to admit to myself without feeling guilty that I was scared. My father used to have a great deal of contempt for cowards. But his father was the coward. He allowed this to happen to his son and the other children.
Other questions?
Okay. That's my time.
Good.
What was the relationship between Todd and the inmate when he was on death row? And do you think that that was good, bad, or indifferent?
I think it was good, and that was very surprising to me. Then it wouldn't surprise me now because I know some of the inmates. In fact, that was the only place this young man ever had what he considered love. The men on death row, as sick as some of them were, who had committed horrible crimes, decided they were going to take care of him, protect him. They afforded him some of the toiletries if they had extra money or some little treat here and there. They especially made sure he had enough to read. Good literature, and the comment about Dante in that one passage is this young man really studied a lot of classic literature, and I think his writing was getting quite good. As a poet, sometimes I wish I could get that far outside myself, but the men were very kind to him. And going into the prison for the first time, that's not what I thought I would find. What I found was so surprising that it's changed my life. I found a spirituality there that makes me feel like I have no spirituality myself. And when I meet with them or correspond with them, they're always challenging me to think about how beautiful my life is. I don't want to cry. You know, I have a memoir coming out in this summer, but it doesn't. It's my early teen years. Actually, I focus on 1957 in Detroit. It's quite a trip. But I have a feeling that the transformation that doing this work created in me will show up in writing in some form. I am putting together a collection of poems I call the prison poems. And I have about 12 and would like 25 to 30 of them. And going back inside the prison is where I'm going to find the kind of courage to write the rest of them. So it'll probably be poetry. Yes. Peggy.
The talk that we're doing now within the legislature as to the status of the death penalty, do you think this book will help enlighten about the
Well, I wish I had a bigger publisher. I have a small press, but bless them, they've been wonderful to me. In many ways, even financially, the small press was an advantage. But if I could get the story out to the right people, I think it would make a difference. Because even people who start out, I have a lot of people who come to my readings and they just want to argue with me about the death penalty. And after they look at the case carefully, we have a couple of them in Michigan right now, so I hear from a lot of those people. Yeah, getting the word out, getting this book out to people. I mean, it was published 2 years ago, and it's just now catching on. And of course, the people most interested are the people in this audience, universities, the religious community fighting the death penalty, the Sisters of Peace are getting this book out. And so the Criminal Justice Department in another state has adopted it on the reading list. Those kinds of things will be helpful. But I won't give up. I do a lot of my own PR. A lot of my PR comes from out of the death row. As you know, some of the contacts I make are through the prisoners. They have contacts far and wide of good people.
One more question?
Yes. No, he was given, he was given not the kind of drugs he needed, mostly tranquilizers and things to calm him down or put him to sleep. No, he didn't get psychiatric care, the kind of care he should have gotten. And at one point, he became so dangerous in prison, they advised the psychiatrist that he was working with not to go in and see him anymore, especially that second stint. When he was waiting to be released during that second trial, he got really, really, really bad, didn't want to see anyone. And when they tried to send religious people in to talk to him, that's when he really went crazy. Once he got to the psychiatric hospital, he was put on a lot of different medication and was stabilized. But then once he was in the group home, some of those dangerous signs were starting to show again. And I end the book on that, kind of that, where he was going. I was surprised when I found out about his death.
What about the state of legislation in Kentucky? Can a juvenile still be convicted?
No.
No.
I think as of, was it the 80s? I left most of my, somebody in the audience probably knows better than I do, but as of 89, I believe it was, neither those under 18 or those considered mentally ill can be executed or charged with a capital offense. But there are men on death row right now in the state who have very low IQ, who should never have been there, who never got help there. And it would be like locking up a six-year-old. Yes?
There's been some U.S. Supreme Court cases about people who are, so that now the U.S. Supreme Court said that you cannot execute a juvenile or someone who is mentally retarded, but they've left the definition of what that means up to the states, and there's a case currently pending in front of the U.S. Supreme Court
also, along with that, sometimes a juvenile is charged, put into prison as a juvenile or juvenile detention center. And as soon as, if they're still incarcerated when they turn 18, they're sent to an adult prison. And we have 22 cases in America since the 70s of people who were executed, were accused as teens, stayed there into their 20s and were executed.
Well, one more question.
Have you ever, as you do this talk, have you ever placed us with the other nations in relation to how many nations there is still in the country?
I should, and I do have the notes, but I, off the top of my head, I can't tell you. But I tell you when I do, when I look at what our prison system is like and how many people we incarcerate, you know, I feel like we're a third world nation.
Good. The number of person, I'm so envious.
I know you are.
Are you ever aware of the way in which so many people are placed in prison and really not belong there, but rather need to be receiving some sort of psychological care?
And that happens a lot, and it happens in my state of Michigan. Because in Michigan, they literally have knocked down some of the institutions where they used to place people, and the lack of funds end up on the street, either in jail for a while and then on the street. Right now, Michigan's fighting a case where I think it's a 13 or 14-year-old killed his abusive grandfather. And the way Michigan attorneys, defense attorneys, are fighting it is they're claiming that someone that age really doesn't understand the Miranda rights. So they're going through the back door with that one.
Well, on that note,
have you ever gone into the idea of, when you do this research, the number of people who have been placed in death row murdered?
Yes, and I think we've had a lot in the news. There's that wonderful program on now that I encourage all of you to watch. It's called Death Row Stories. There's a new one every week of someone. It's on, what channel? Does anyone know what channel that's on? But it's on every Sunday. Yes. It's over 100, and again, Robert Redford is getting very active in his later years, and he is the sponsor of that program with Susan Sarandon, who played the role in Dead Man Walking. They're both involved, and so once a week now, there's a death row story where someone was proven innocent, sometimes before they were executed, but many times after the execution.
On behalf of our friends organization, I want to thank you this small token of appreciation. It's really been a trip from, I won't say from hell, but it's been a difficult trip for our speaker, who started off from Flint, Michigan, and found her way with lost luggage to New York, only to finally make her way to Louisville and down to us. So we appreciate your perseverance and glad you could be with us.
And I want to stay here, actually.